Well, that would explain why Lyman wouldn't let me bring anything. I'd also like to point out I'm from Texas. I've never seen this before. All right, so I'm here to give a report in the mode of a status update about the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. It's a telescope that's been in the field for about 18 months, although that I'm afraid even then that's a little misleading, because almost as soon as we got there in late 2007, we turned around and came back for various reasons. But mainly they worked to finish assembling the instrument and to get going with a real survey during the year 2008. So we've already heard about a rather similar instrument, the South Pole Telescope, and so I'll try to remember to highlight differences and not spend too much time on the things that are similar, since Bill laid it out so cleanly already. But I do believe that there's a room for more than one observatory doing this sort of thing, looking for clusters and other science. And wherever possible, I hope that whatever systematic errors there are in one approach can help cancel out or be weighed against those of another. This is what the sky looks like in Chile at night, actually. So you're a natural philosopher. You want to learn about clusters and cosmology. You sit with the microwave background behind you. You think about what you want. And what we want here, our measurement goal, is to come up with sky maps in three different microwave bands and to map the CMB anisotropy in those bands. Those are 1 to 2 millimeters. These are not the same three bands that SPT has been using recently. There are multiple science goals that we would then do with that one measurement goal. And I highlight surveying first in the Ives Village clusters because that's the point of the meeting. It's also the one that we're nearest to coming to fruition on, I think. But don't forget, of course, there are other ones, as you heard about from our friends at the South Pole, including, as well as finding these clusters, and those, above all, include finding or measuring the temperature power spectrum in CMB itself. So today, I have only information, really, about the 145 gigahertz camera, and not the arrays at 215 and 280 gigahertz, the ones we're so excited about. We'll come back to why. But the power of having multiple frequency observations is shown by these maps that we made, simulations, at three different frequencies. So first of all, it's worth remembering that although this is a relatively clean way to be looking for clusters, the millimeter wave sky, like any other wavelength doing any other physics, it's still complicated and difficult, and there are a lot of elements. So these simulations that we've used as our input cosmologies, thanks to Luma, and Kevin Huffenberger and Yorosh Seljak put these together. They have five main components, including the cosmic microwave background. Here we're looking at a patch of, I can't remember if it's 2 degrees square or 2 square degrees. And if the primary CMB really does look like a dragon hopping on a camel, then you would see something like the primary CMB in all the bands, of course, but these other effects all modulate that differently in the different bands, including, above all, our favorite, the thermal SC effect. And some effects which are, I should say these gray images are all from the 275 simulation. That's why the SC effect appears positive, and why infrared point sources appear so overwhelming. But with clean, faithful maps in all three components, we would hope to learn as much as possible to separate them. So that's where we're trying to head. So just like any other instrument of its size, this team is big, comprises institutions from multiple universities, multiple countries, continents even. We have South Africans and South Americans on the team. This is a photo of the telescope in roughly this time 2 years ago, before the fixed ground screen that surrounds it had finished being installed. Now, I try to follow a policy of never showing pictures of the Atacama site with any clouds whatsoever in the picture. Because it's bad politics. But I'll point out this was February, when we don't try to observe. Now you can't really see anything from below because it's all surrounded. And here's Dan Swetz putting things together in what we call our cleanish room in the Atacama, when the receiver had to be reassembled and the actual detector elements, which had been hand carried by him and two other graduate students down to the site, were put in our sort of clean room on the site. I'd like to say I painted in the clouds too, just to make it look better. Yeah, that's real sunset. We also have a logo. over there. So here's a photo of the site from above, and you can see it's the only way you can still see the telescope without having to walk up inside this ground screen, which is about 5 stories tall. It's reflective. The outer one, of course, is fixed, and it's designed to reflect stray radiation to the sky. It's as roughly as white to microwaves as it is to your eye, invisible light. What you can see from above here is we're looking at the at the secondary mirror is placed here, and the primary has its back to us, so you're only seeing enclosure around it. And there's all sorts of support required here to operate on this site. This is at 5,200 meters or 17,000 feet, which may not still be, but was briefly at least, the highest fixed telescope in the world.
I'm glad you put that fixed in there.
We had a lot of debate about that.
Yeah, it's strange.
Well, we sunk concrete piers, so that's what I mean.
So what is the higher one?
There's something nearby that did.
Yeah, we have a telescope that's several hundred meters higher, but it's not.
You never know. There goes
the mirror.
So this site is near the Tropic of Capricorn. It's near where Chile, Bolivia, and Argentina meet in the Atacama Desert in northwest Chile. Very dry site. I like to say one of the world's two driest sites for millimeter wave astronomy. But as many telescopes as there are out there, it's a surprisingly isolated place to work. And I noticed this as I was looking at the photos of the dark sector land and all the support staff. This is the only thing for about 5 miles. Now, the two other things that are 5 miles away happen to be APEX and CBI. So if you need parts, tools, there are friends nearby. But we do have to run our own operations, including inside the White House. This is not where we have the graduate students sleep. This is where we keep the diesel generators, keep the thing running. A major improvement in the last 5 years has been to have full-time internet on the site, and that involves a microwave link aimed at by line of sight to the town where we can get 20 megabytes a second, without which I think we would have just about no data whatsoever. When Mark Devlin's in town, this is how you get to the site. Hike over the Andes to the Okay, so the camera sits on a Gregorian telescope, which is 6 meters in diameter, although that glosses over a little bit the fact that we built the primary somewhat oversized, and 6 meters is about the section we illuminate of a 7-meter primary mirror. It's a Gregorian system where the secondary mirror is 2 meters in diameter, is not kept cold, and has a relatively long focal length off that Gregorian. It's fast, it's compact as we could make it in order to have it do scanning and modulating on the sky as fast as possible in a way similar to what the Hubble telescope does. It's made out of these facets about the size of a human torso. There's 71 of them. They're about 1.5 meters tall and 1/2 meter wide. There's Michele Limon trying to parameterize them and measure their exact location. On the one hand, this was a really hard method. This involves laser tracking, so there's a robot you can't see in the foreground of the picture. It's kind of like R2-D2, and it follows Michele around. He has a corner cube, which is a retroreflector, and on the end of a wand, not unlike this, so as you climb over, you place this on the different corners, and the robot measures the distance, and so we end up with information about the location of the primary segments, and of course, they also have to be adjusted by screws and so forth. It was a very challenging method. I'm not sure we would recommend that to others. On the other hand, it finally does seem to work very cleanly, and we're happy with where we ended up with the facets, the primary and secondary. And we believe we have better than 30 micron RMS this season on the primary facets. And not only that, they're within 20 microns RMS of where we left them 6 months ago, or in January when they were last characterized. So we think we have a very stable system that meets our science goals and doesn't change when we leave it for several months out of the wind and other things. It's not like the tarp over this when you go away. The camera itself has re-imaging optics. It's a cryostat that's smaller than a Volkswagen Bug, about a meter in each dimension. Uses various, this is an Institute for Theoretical Physics, right? I think I have to keep going. Some unusual bits are inside the cryostat. The cold re-imaging optics use lenses, refractive optics, which, of course, when Galileo invented the telescope 400 years ago, were the state of the art. But they're a little bit unusual in this particular wave band. you can see from light in the top right image, you can see light coming in through a window, and it's been imaged by the Gregorian, and it's re-imaged at a much faster, at low magnification, to come up with faster mapping speed. And the things that do it are these, in each camera, or each array of the camera, are silicon lenses which have to be anti-reflection coated. And we think we have a pretty successful technique, and we really never think about these lenses anymore. It's just, it seems to have worked. But there is a catch. One of the key design decisions is whether we should have three bands all looking in the same place on the sky using dichroic beam splitting filters, or to pay the price of not perfectly overlapping maps and instead let them be three separate elements looking at three nearby but distinct places on the sky. And you can see we chose the latter. I think that was the right choice, but as you can see, the three cameras here with the colors suggesting the frequencies of the microwave band are separated by a distance that's about equal to their own size. And we pushed that distance, that separation, as low as possible, but that's where we ended up. You also see these three bullseyes are the size of the full-width half-maximum and the Rayleigh criteria, if this were an airy disk. So in other words, those are the beam sizes of three different frequency rays. The detectors themselves are TES bolometers. They're supplied by the Goddard group of Harvey-Moseley. And they are made with usual microfabrication techniques, but the absorber system is somewhat different from spiderweb bolometers. These are actually just very thin sheets of silicon, 1 millimeter square, 1.055 if you're actually trying to machine something to it. Silicon itself would be a terrible absorber. Think a bolometer, of course, is really two things. It's something black and a thermometer. And the blackness comes not from the silicon, but from an implant made to make it somewhat more reflective, which actually maximizes absorption. And then the detector itself, the bling, as it were, is this small TES device on the front side of it, the absorbing side of it. So they use superconducting transition, and we hold them through electrothermal feedback at their transition temperature, which in the case of these devices is almost all around 0.45 Kelvin. These are fabricated in a way which they're made 33 at a time. So these are called pop-up detectors because in a single silicon chip, you make arrays that are about 2 inches, about yay big, and they have 33 millimeters long, aren't they? They're fabricated monolithically, and you can see one detector and two of its neighbors before they're folded, actually, and folding was a pretty dicey process, which I think we mastered pretty well. By the end, we were breaking hardly any of these devices. What gets folded are the legs, the support wiring behind the TES and its absorber, so they fold back just like in this last image. So these three detectors or four detectors are facing light from my direction, and then they have legs for carrying off both heat and the electrical signal behind them. So when we put this together, we have three different arrays within the camera, each with 32 by 32 set of detectors, because after having folded lines of 32, we stacked 32 of them in proximity as close as we could arrange. Their separation in the stacking direction is about 10% more, but these guys are already less than one beam separated, neighboring detectors are. So that's we think a relatively unimportant effect. In the first year, we went to the field with just one of the three arrays in place in the full cryostat. The first detectors were the 150 gigahertz detectors, and we had a few weeks with them. And then we took the entire cryostat back by airplane to North America, where it was reassembled with the second and third arrays. And so here's a photo of 3,000 detectors. You have to take my word for it that they're different, because it's really not visible to the naked eye. Although they are fabricated differently, that's one key thing. They would not be easily interchangeable. And the main reason is their saturation power is designed to capture what we expect the atmosphere to do to them in the Atacama site. There is one unusual thing we did that I don't know if it would be repeated, and that is this high resistivity silicon coupling layer we put in front of these devices. So when you have an infinitesimally thin absorber, no matter what you do to its surface resistivity, you can't get it to absorb more than half the light, in theory, supposing that there's vacuum behind it and nothing else. And the coupling layer was designed to make a more complicated system, just like an anti-reflective coating on optical devices. The more complicated system allows you to pass more through a lens. This was designed to absorb more in the detectors. And what we found was that part of the theory worked very well. And And so we went back to the field this year with the cover still on, the 150 gigahertz array. Unfortunately, it seems that the thickness of the piece of silicon that was required over this was, in the 280 gigahertz case, of course, it's half as thick as the 150 gigahertz case. And we found, we believe, that there are microphonic vibrations in this layer of 35 millimeters square that were causing, effectively, atmospheric light to be coupled in at rather high frequencies. So we went back in January and took the coupling layer off of the highest frequency camera. And although it pained most of us, we also took it off the low frequency camera. So what that should do is lower the raw sensitivity, but we hope make them much cleaner detectors, particularly at the highest frequencies. So I said earlier that I'm only presenting 145 gigahertz results. This is a large factor, is that there were so many lines and other features in the power spectrum of 280 gigahertz that we haven't written it off, but on the other hand, it's not been worth our expenditure, the very precious commodity of human time so far. We are very hopeful that next year, which starts possibly tonight, things could go considerably better with that. So they're read out with SQUID because the signal fundamentally is a current, and what better way to read out a microscopic current than a SQUID? One key difference here between this system and the South Pole Telescope readout system is that these are multiplexed in the time domain, meaning that each detector is always on, but it's only being read out for 2 microseconds out of every 66 microseconds through a system of turning on and off first stage SQUIDs and coupling their output into second stage SQUIDs. And the microfab, the actual low-level circuits that do this, are fabricated by NIST, the Boulder group of Ken Irwin. And then the readout electronics, the warm electronics, come. They even have their own multi-channel electronics designed initially for SCUBA 2 by Mark Kaplan's group at British Columbia. So the idea is that although it won't seem like it when you're analyzing data, what you're really doing is reading out one row of detectors at a time for 2 microseconds each. Yeah, historical problem. So there are several prices we pay for not being at the South Pole, I know. And you guys didn't even bring up the one of which I am most jealous. I think it's the number of sunsets you have per year is one. And we have one every night, it turns out.
So do they.
What's that?
So do they.
Yes. The frequency of our sunsets is somewhat larger. And this, we think, is one of the key advantages, the ability to observe the same part of the sky scanning horizontally but in different directions, cross-link observing. So on the top left here, we've got sort of a day in the life of the act on the sky. We observe each night something like 8 p.m. local until well after dawn. Partly it's because we're protected from the direct sunlight by the mountain. Another factor which you may not appreciate if you've not tried to observe in microwave bands is that, in fact, the sky is really not dark at night and blue during the day. It's gray all hours of the night or day. And day is only slightly worse than night. So you would naively think perhaps we could observe all day. And it turns out there are two reasons we can. One is just cryogenics. We have closed cycle refrigerators, and we have to spend several hours each day recycling them. But it turns out that even that isn't the only thing, that the telescope itself, made of aluminum, expands and contracts thermally in a way that is well under control at night, but it prevents us from really believing the data we get after the sun actually crosses above the Andes in the east. And we've shown this to ourselves by making maps of Saturn before and after sunrise, and it's just unambiguous that the beam is very clean at night and not during the day. A night in the life, is that we scan over, we've experimented with different scan distances and scan frequencies, but we settled last year into a pattern of observing a full 6 degrees in azimuth, scanning back and forth 8 seconds each, which may not sound like very much, but when you're there in front of this 50-ton machine, which is seamlessly scanning to the left, and then you blink and it's scanning to the right, it's pretty impressive robotic achievement. And no credit to the physicists. We paid robotic engineers to do that. Actually, there's a lot of credit because it didn't work.
What was the total time that you spent from the observations to sunrise?
Nightly?
Yeah.
Well, so we are continuing to observe more hours, I'm sure, than we think we can use. So typically, this is actually the number of hours that we're doing the observations. And then we probably have to chuck some of the data, particularly once summer comes and sunrise is fairly early. So that's a night by night variable. And in fact, we just look at the data and use a sets of cuts that we designed to try to reject this. There are a few hard limits, but those aren't the ones that really just determine when we can go.
And you have a sense of how the weather's going?
Yes, thanks to our good friends 5 miles away at Apex SC.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. We have a weather monitor, but it's really only your a thing we could all go by and find out about surface temperature, humidity, pressure, things like that. The really helpful thing is that Apex has shared with, and thanks, props, shared with us the output of a tipping radiometer, which really is finding what we care most about, the precipitable body vapor fraction. So we split that time up according to something that we call midnight, which is, of course, not a midnight, it's more like 2 a.m. We spent half of the time looking east of the south celestial pole, and then the second half of the night looking at the southwest. And the idea is that at the particular declination and elevation that we've chosen to observe, you're seeing the same stuff in the first and second half of the night, both before and after its meridian crossing. And most nights we spend a few minutes looking for a planet. I think we may reduce the frequency of doing that. But when you do see a planet, the scanning means you have something that looks like this. This is 10 time streams for how many seconds? Half a second? No, a quarter of a second. When those 10 neighboring detectors were all observing Mars, they're in a horizontal line, and Mars passes in front of each in succession. The blue one shows X's at the sample rate. So we're for the lowest frequency band, we're dramatically oversampling this. But we want to deal with a simple system where we were sampling all the data in any camera at the same rate. Even then, I think we're a little aggressive. We're reading out the detectors at 400 samples a second, which causes certain data quantity nightmares for me. Okay, so anyway, you see each spot in two distinct stripes. You see in the southeast and southwest, and having scanned in those two different directions, we have maps which are cross lanes, and this has been the key to the success of many projects, including WMAP, Boomerang, and many others in the field. So I said there's a lot of data, and there is a lot of data. There are a lot of data. There are a lot of data. The data themselves are the readouts from a third level of SQUID. They're currents, effectively, but they're not really currents. They're not the currents that come out of SQUID. SQUIDs are super nonlinear. We have three of them in a row. And even the TES bolometers themselves are almost as nonlinear as, in fact, yeah, everything in the system is nonlinear. So the way that we actually have anything at all linear in the data set we care about, the microwave temperature, is by applying feedback to the first stage of SQUIDs, servoing that feedback, turning the dial to make sure that the output is always constant, as near as possible. This is the job of the multi-channel electronics. And then finding out what the knob setting had to be, that's our data. So in fact, it's the knowing signal required to keep the skies, to keep the output of the whole system from changing. And so because those are sampled at 400 hertz, there's a digital filter involved to get the aliasing out of the system. So we have a Nyquist anti-aliasing filter that filters about 140 hertz. So, but if you put those 400 samples per second, the number of bytes, number of detectors, numbers of red, we're getting almost 20 gigabytes of data every hour, which is a little excessive. Although I put this thing in yellow because I personally, that was one of my hobbies. I don't commute by train, but if I did, that's what I would have worked on. Was a lossless compression system. So we can get that down by a factor of 3 and then reinflate it in North America or wherever we want to do our analysis. But even then, a single copy of the raw data is a couple of terabytes every month. We use the well-known HDOA protocol for getting data to North America. It's the hard drive on airplanes. So if you go down and you're in the group, you carry hard drives back. We actually have, never mind. We only dropped 10 disks on the tarmac, but they were all OK. unfortunately, we find that there's not a lot of good things, easy, clean things you can do to reduce the data, sort of making maps. So we get straight to work on pipeline. And yeah, we have a. You have an icon for that, too.
Is there going to be a board game for this?
Funny thing is, I don't even know which member of the group it is who keeps making these.
Better for their career that you don't.
I have a guess. No, it's not true. So here's what some of the data look like. I picked 6 detectors, 5 minutes of data. And along the top in brown, you're seeing that's just the azimuth readout in degrees, not in millikelvin CMB, and just showing the scan frequency so you can compare the data. And these are 6 detectors, and on a night that was in the best 50%, but not the best 25% of nights from the 2008 season. And there's a lot of junk. There's a lot of atmosphere. If you look on long time scales, like 5 minutes, the signal is atmosphere. So the first treatment we do in normal data analysis is to take out a common mode. By common mode here, I mean the average of all, not all detectors, but all good detectors. I should take one step back and say that we analyze each of these arrays completely separately. They're treated as separate data products, and we would try to make maps with them separately. Everything is done separately, separate between two cameras. Okay, so a common mode across the array is removed. And then we have a much calmer data set. But there's still a lot of information in it, and you can see that a lot of what's going on here is at the scan frequency of 0.12 hertz. And and our job is to get rid of that.
So what do you think dominates that, that signature constant elevation?
I think there are two things, and we know this by looking more at phase here. One thing, of course, is still atmosphere. In spite of going to constant elevation, there's still some gradients. But I think, in fact, I've not done one step to these data that we always do, which is to look for, there's actually an out of phase with the scan contribution. And we believe that has to do with magnetic pickup. And squids, as you well know, aren't really current readout devices. They're magnetic field readout devices.
Is that happening in the first stage or the, like, we use the same?
I don't know, we got all these squids.
I'm just asking because we use the same second stage.
Oh, you use a different first stage?
Well, we don't have a first stage.
Well, so we've gone through multiple generations of first stage, including first the point squid, then the gradiometer, then the quadrant, I don't even think it has a name, where they fabricate the squid in more and more sections with opposite sensitivities to external magnetic fields to try to cancel out the slope and then the quadratic term. We certainly saw this get less as we move to these better generations of the NIST squid.
We see it in squid, because we just don't see it in the detectors.
Yeah. The modulation frequency.
At this level?
Oh yeah, the squid DC signals look like that.
Yeah. Yeah. The modulation frequency of this number. So your second stage is presumably shielded, so it's probably the first stage squids, which is harder than the shield with your tubes.
Right. Well, they are all shielded in the sense that they're in multiple layers of new metal, but because of it, it's still harder.
So that's inconsistent with atomic set. Anyway,
all right, over here.
Let's talk about it later.
Remember, Institute of Theoretical Physics. Okay, so here's a, I guess, 10 minutes of time, a 6-minute stare at Saturn, one detector, just to show again what it looks like as you scan across the planet. Here, of course, we're seeing many scans as the planet drifts. I don't know if this would be rising or setting, probably it is rising. So as it rises through, the beam of the detector falls first more and more on the planet and less when you scan. And you can invert those and make a map. So a single 6-minute stare at Saturn. The map of Saturn looks like that from a single 6-minute observation. And so this is, I guess, well understood down to 40 dB, and then we can make a beam profile and hope that a symmetrized beam is going to do the trick. And it matches well with predictions. So we understand our beams pretty well. We can do this with all three arrays. So this is, I said I won't show data for other frequencies, which is true, but this is one thing that is working well in all the arrays. And the beams are about where we expect for the data we're talking about today. That means that we're at 1.4 arc minutes full width half maximum for the beam.
Joe, is any of that structure from the complicated objects that goes into
the structure in Saturn?
Yeah, just here. We had a nice model of it, so.
Yeah, so some of the structure, which is symmetric, of course, we are very aggressively illuminating the primary dish. So you would expect to see some of the features in the area disk. That would still, of course, be rotationally symmetric. And so I think, that's what you're seeing in the green model, in these dips due to the aggressive illumination. I don't think it's optics. I think it's primary mirror facets. And the reason is that we can see those kinds of structures become more pronounced when we look at the data that come from the 9 a.m. Saturn observations. Okay, so again, I won't say about the technical details of calibration, but to help you understand what it is that we are required to get any data out of it, to flat field these detectors, we use the response to the atmosphere,
And so that's what the two plots show on the right hand, the actual result from looking at the atmosphere and finding out the coupling of the atmosphere to each individual detector over about four nights of data, the entire night's worth. That's the 145 and the 215 gigahertz camera. We have a little bit of trouble agreeing on what the names of these arrays are. And I guess the impression I want to leave you with there is, first of all, how many detectors work at least at some level? And when they don't work, it tends to be rows or columns. That has to do with problems in wire bonds. And we'd love to be able to go back in there and replace some of those, but it doesn't always happen. Another is just that the detectors are surprisingly uniform, that the RMS of each of these is about 10%. So that they really are coupling to the sky just about the same amount. I never would have guessed in advance that they would be that similar, considering how many things could be different. We have modeled for their time variation on minute-type timescales. And these are 2 to 5% level effects, depending on how the weather is. And the two parts that go into it are the opacity and also the sky loading, which changes the nonlinear detector response. That opacity is the one variable which helps us understand both of these. And one is a detector-only effect, as the loading changes, their gain changes a bit at a few percent level. And the other is just the how much you lose between here and the top of the atmosphere. And again, APEX has been very generous with the data. We can cross-check both of those things before, though, with a pulse source. And we have. It's just not as good a signal to noise, so that's not going to be our final thing. And then finally, for absolute calibration, we long dreamed of and continue to dream of making good maps where we can cross-calibrate to the WMAP data set. And it just it's going to be hard because the range of angular frequencies where we both have good coverage is it doesn't jump out at you. It takes a lot of good map making work. So we're not here yet. For now, we're using the response to two different planets, Saturn and Uranus, as the absolute calibrator. For a long time, we did Saturn because it's so incredibly much brighter, I think two orders of magnitude. But in fact, Uranus is a better understood source. So once we have very sensitive maps, we felt it made more sense, but in reality, they agreed a couple of percent. Planets, again, give us both the arrangement of detectors within the focal plane, which is not modeled so much as it's empirical reading out from data. And finally, a global pointing model. Planets are never in the same place as the fields. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to use those fields. So to connect the dots of different plots, point sources in the CMB field. They're not very numerous, but there are a few that are bright enough that this is just not an issue. So to summarize how the camera did so far in the small fraction of the first year, in the second year, we had something like 50 to 80% of detectors worked at some level. Now, those numbers are somewhat generous ones. Those are detectors, they're not quite as generous as the previous plot where I showed basically everyone works a little and you can get some information about the top of the sky. We're still fighting about what kinds of cuts and the appropriate ones to do, so I think the full number will not be quite that good. But those are for the 600 is at the lowest frequency, 800 is at the 220 gigahertz camera. And for the detectors that pass cuts, not all 600 of them, we're finding that typical microkelvin CMB sensitivity is 700 microkelvin CMB root seconds in the 150 gigahertz camera, which, although it's well above a proposal value, it's considerably below where we thought we might be as we were starting to put this camera together. So we feel pleased about it. We don't have a number for the next two cameras, though. For total amount of data during those 2 years, almost all of it was in the 2008 year. And I'd say that this is divided between data we can't use would be about a quarter of it. Maybe a quarter of it is on the equator, and then half of it is in the south. And I'll show you where those fields are in just a minute. But I don't know if I said the history. We only got about 5 weeks of data in that first year before we had to pull the camera. So the map-making problem is a hard one, of course, unless you're just writing down the answer, as John always reminds me, oh, it's just linear algebra. In fact, we can write it down right here in yellow. Now, for the masters of linear algebra, maybe it is just linear algebra, but the things we're inverting start to be a billion by a billion noise noise covariance matrices, so that's not at all practical, and that's just per hour of observing. So the goal is to come up with the appropriate map, M, with finite amount of computer time without losing information that you know about the noise covariance matrix in your data. So we don't have all the answers, but I do want to say a few things about our philosophy of of how to approach the problem. One is, first of all, that when I show some cluster images in a few minutes, those are done with a separate analysis. It has a lot of the same principles, certainly has the same calibration, but to make smaller maps, we just find that we can make different assumptions about the various, the data set smaller when you're just trying to do a targeted observation. Another is that we find that in spite of all the things we do, we still have to do a high pass filter on the data. And the one we're currently working with is about 0.5 hertz. That corresponds to L of about 200. So the first peak is being filtered out intentionally by us because most of what we're seeing there is atmosphere in the first place. But then the next step that we're exploring exactly how we want to do is to try to find noisy modes, common mode, but other modes as well. And those other modes you might think are probably largely sky gradients, even slightly quadratics and things. But rather than prejudging what these are going to be, we're experimenting with how you might find the noisiest modes among all the 1,000 detectors, and the hope that that will cover both atmospheric information that we don't want and correlated noise that really is designed in, not designed in, found in the readout system itself. So we have both a couple of different people looking at how to do that. And we hope to be able to get back the data and not all the way down to 0.5 hertz or L of 200, but in the L of 200 to 1,000 range as well as possible by trying to iterate on our map making solution by resolving for these noisy modes after you have a map. And finally, to take the advantages of cross-linking into account, we want to have noise weighting in which we put together cross-link maps, take a rising map and a setting map. They need to be nice and clean and relatively uniform in their depth throughout, and then actually combine them in Fourier space. At a point with these guys first, I guess the point was just that if you have a map, whether it's stripy or not, these are simulations of something a little more ambitious than we actually got. If you high pass filter the map itself, you can see point sources, clusters. These things are not the hardest part of making the good map. So it's the next few steps. Case-based noise weighting, I want to show an example of that. So this is like the one map in my group will actually let me show. Now, this has a lot of the effects of cross-linked maps where you combine the two maps without doing some sort of weighting. You just or you noise weight them in the map space. You can have crossed, you can have stripes in both directions. When you go to take power spectrum, this is I think 6 orders of magnitude, a logarithmic power spectrum in K-space. There are a number of features, but the ones that jump out at you, I think, should be the vertical and horizontal, but of course, horizontal vertical stripes, not respectively, of course. And so if you've made a single map of cross-linked data, then this is what you got to work with. But if you can make the map separately, then each should have either a horizontal or a vertical band, which are these stripes that come from atmosphere not properly removed and so forth. If you can do the noise weighting in K-space and then combine them, then you can give relatively little weight to each of these in the plus and try to get the best possible, not just power spectrum, but map on the Fourier transform side of things. I have another realization of this same power spectrum, by the way. This is why my group lets me show this.
So your cross-linking is at 90 degrees?
We have two different fields, and the answer is different in the two different places. It is not really 90 degrees in either. In one field, it's about 60, and the other is 75 to 80. Of course, it even varies across the field. So as we were talking about offline, there's some interesting things you could possibly do by the fact that these are not being rotated by exactly 90, because this is not CDK.
Why are these at 90?
Because it's Obama. Yeah. It's just conceptually. So here are the regions we would look at tonight if we were cold. This is the FDS dust map, and you're looking at declination increasing upward and right ascension increasing to the left. It's so hard to be a physicist and do that. And over the course of the coming year, we hope to fill out bands in both declination zero range and declination 50 to 55 south. Last year, we were primarily observing in this southern region and, in fact, filled in a lot more all the way around. But this year, we want to get a lot more data on the SDSS stripe 82. So when we make our current maps, and like I said, we're still iterating in the human sense on trying to figure out exactly what we want to do. We do feel confident that for the 2008 data alone, we'll have a sensitivity that looks something like the upper map. These are microkelvin CMB units on the color scale, and so there's a large core region where the typical map RMS is 30 to 50 microkelvin arc minute. We're not actually pixelizing arc minute scales, but that seems like that's the point of the realm to talk about the noise per surface area. And covering a range of about 5 degrees by something like a quarter of the sky or a little more. So effectively, we say that we have about 500 square degrees equivalent data. We think we'll have equivalent map of 40 microkelvin CMB. And what did I have to say about the lower one? I guess that we did have some amount of data in the galaxy, which is at RA 7 to 11 in this particular declination band, but relatively little. So we did not do any targeted observations of any sources besides planets last year, and of course those were for engineering. So the bullet cluster here, as you see, is extracted from the regular observations, where in fact it was even more unfortunate than large parts of the map. This is 31 nights of observing, and for various technical reasons, and when we were and were not in the field, and when the weather was in Bolivia, it's not even very well cross-linked. I think the numbers were 23 and 8 observations in the two different directions. Let's see, you see above a disk which is not just the beam, but the beam and the smoothing filter that's been applied to the map after it was made, just for presentation. And on the right side, the null map of the same field. Here, by null, we mean that this is the first half of all those 31 observations and the second half subtracted. Here's the unfortunate bit about where it was in the sky. It's just as we were finishing the season. And it was at the very edge of observations as well. Just to compare to the X-ray data from Chandra, are the black contours and the dark matter lensing map of the white contours. So just as the other groups who've observed this have shown, we're certainly seeing something consistent with where the X-ray and where the X-ray sits the electrons are, and not where the dark matter is found to be. Can you really tell? Can you really tell?
Yeah.
Well, what about the bullet?
I mean, based on your resolution.
Well, I didn't show the resolution element here, did I? I'm not prepared to put a significance on that statement.
Okay.
I feel pretty confident. Here's another cluster that we knew in advance, but again extracted from what is eventually to be a large map. This cluster we had somewhat better observations, so the RMS in that region of map is about 60 microkelvin arc minute. These maps are all, by the way, 24 arc minutes across, so about a quarter of a square degree. Here's four other clusters. Again, we didn't target them, but they happen to be in the field. Two of them were announced as discoveries in October, and we certainly see them. These, I'm pretty sure, are the two highest significance SPT clusters of the four that were announced in the October paper by Zach et al. I don't know what to make of that structure in the top left-hand one. And then we have two other candidates for clusters that maybe they're discovered. We haven't finished our search, but we're not aware of them having been seen in SE before. Having heard Bill's talk, I wouldn't be shocked if this lower left-hand one was mentioned earlier today without points.
Yeah, yeah. You know roughly the RA?
I have it somewhere. I intentionally didn't write it down. I've got to believe that's the 50C.
Yeah.
Here are the same four fields, but with the first minus second half difference done. And,
right.
That's for real. So I just have one last thing to leave with. As I said, we're still changing how we do this map, understanding exactly what we can do to get low-L power. Here's a sample from what we hope, a sample from the FOLAC map. This is the RMS section you've seen before. Just shows what size this chunk of 60 square degrees is. And again, this is a sum map and a difference map, divided by two, obviously. Here, the halving was alternating every 15 minutes, not every half of the season, but I think that's a technical detail. So we certainly see stuff that goes away when we take differences that should null out the sky. So thank God. Otherwise, they're long 6 years. Anyway, the message to leave you with is that ACT is starting to observe again tonight, tomorrow, something like that, and that we have some data in the can, and that we're going to be, that we see real clusters, and that we're going to be proceeding as well as we can to make clean maps of the parts of the sky that we've seen. Thanks.
The structures, the substructures that you see in this, on the top white and on the bottom white, they suddenly look significant looking at your point spectrum.
Well, it's certainly bigger than the PSF.
Yeah.
So if the structure is statistically significant, I don't know what to say about that one. That lower right-hand one, we actually debated whether we should be mentioning it all because it looks so funny.
What else do you think it is?
So I have a noise number on it. The RMS noise there was 50 micro, no, yeah, 50 microkelvin. That's 90 observations. That's about as many observations as we get. So in terms of depth, for the data we've gotten, that's about as deep as it could get. So that's not an excuse.
CMB?
It is big. That would be, I guess, the first thing I'd want to do if we did have 215 maps would be to compare at the SC null and see how much of it goes red.
Did you look at the deep optical
map?
Yes, when it goes wet.
Did you look at any deep optical map or x-rays?
It is only x-rays that, I shouldn't say, I don't know what's been looked for these. These two are fairly hot off the press. As I understood, it was only x-rays that we looked at. But at least one of these is in BCS. So. Well, I guess it's the... Is this one in BCS? No. Well, I shouldn't say.
I don't know.
What about the top
right.
White? It's an SPT cluster. Do you see it the same shape? I mean, is it clumped like that?
It doesn't look like much.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. We do feel when we do our cluster search and we heavily filter the map, so we are removing a lot of things.
So
more diffuse emission we're not sensitive to.
Okay.
We wouldn't know. So
this is not FIMSAR?
Well, the grad student who made these maps says these are not filtered. And then you press them on it, and obviously they're filtered in certain ways.
So generally, it doesn't appear morphologically the same.
Whatever. I couldn't imagine that these are the real extended shapes of these clusters. This one starts to be, look, we're talking about a decrement of 100 microk, and that map RMS, I said, was 50. So this is not going to be the instrument, certainly not with the data we already have for understanding morphology, but for having a big section of sky that we think we understand, I think we're well on our way.
Yeah, one more question, maybe.
What are the signal to noise for this? You said 50 microkelvin.
What are the left. Well, so for the bullet cluster, obviously it's in the 10 something sigma range. These others, they're high enough that might have let me show them.
Okay.
Which is considerable.
But
I think we're talking about the 5-6.
The maps are 40 microk, and the SPT ones are.
You're saying 15 or 17 might be recommended in
different parts. 15 sigma.
That kind of looked like an 8 sigma guy.
Okay, thank you very much.